Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Thanksgiving Day 2003 in Iraq. Troops celebrate while U.S. officials deal with a political snag. A leading Muslim cleric demands elections and a role for Islam in the new government. Also, a report card on homeland security. And China tells automakers to make more efficient cars and SUVs, much to the surprise of the automakers.
You can bet the automakers are really going to try to lobby hard for changes over the next few months. They were really caught off guard. They hadn't expected the Chinese to do this.
We'll hear your thoughts on comfort food and give thanks for time spent with a favorite uncle in pursuit of Vermont's snow geese. These stories and more coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The nation is celebrating Thanksgiving today with parades, food, and football. President Bush is spending the day at his Texas ranch. NPR's Jackie Northam reports he'll be enjoying a traditional Thanksgiving feast.
The president and First Lady Laura Bush are spending Thanksgiving in the traditional way, surrounded by family and plenty of good food. Turkey, cornbread dressing, sweet and mashed potatoes, and if there's still room, pecan or pumpkin pie. Their two daughters, Barbara and Jenna, are home for the holidays, and the president's parents, former President Bush and wife Barbara, are also visiting. Over the holidays, the president is due to phone members of the armed forces stationed throughout the world, letting them know how much he and the nation appreciate their service. Like the rest of the country, the Bushes will start to head home on Sunday. On Monday, the First Lady receives the official White House Christmas tree, which will arrive in a horse-drawn wagon. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
Former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton sat down to a dinner of turkey, stuffing, and pumpkin pie with about 50 American soldiers at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan today. Earlier, she said America will stand with Afghanistan as it tries to rebuild from war and Taliban regime. And she said those who hope to reinstate that regime will be disappointed.
The message should go out that the Taliban terrorists are fighting a losing battle. They cannot win because they cannot intimidate and undermine the resolve of the Afghan people to have a future free of this kind of terrorism.
She also said more troops are needed to defeat the insurgents in Afghanistan, but that those do not necessarily have to be American troops. NASA says the International Space Station is in good working order despite concerns that something hit the outpost. The two-member crew had reported hearing a mysterious noise outside the station. From member station WMFE, Pat Duggins reports.
Astronaut Mike Fole and cosmonaut Alexander Kaleri say the mystery noise sounded like crunching metal. They used the camera on the station's 57-foot-long robot arm to check the source of the sound. It was at the back of the Russian-built Zvezda crew compartment where the two were eating breakfast at the time the noise was heard. NASA reports no damage and everything looks fine. Both Fole and Kaleri have first-hand experience with emergencies aboard a space station. Fole was part of a three-member crew on the older Russian space station Mir in 1997 when a robot cargo craft crashed into the Spectre module and punctured it. The crew had to seal off the cabin from the rest of the station since the air was rushing out. Kaleri was aboard Mir on an earlier flight when an oxygen-generating unit caught fire and filled the crew cabin with smoke. Neither incident caused injuries or forced an evacuation. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
A Chinese official says his country plans to put a man on the moon by 2020. The nation's chief space official says China will launch a probe to orbit the moon by 2007. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. In NPR's business update, the nation's newspapers are filled with ads today as retailers try to lure shoppers through their doors tomorrow. The day after Thanksgiving is traditionally known as Black Friday, the day retailers hope will send their annual earnings into the black. Many stores are opening as early as 5 a.m. tomorrow with early bird specials. Bank One says it's been told to expect enforcement action against one group, its mutual fund unit. This is the latest action from the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's been investigating trading practices at many of the industry's high-profile funds. Jay Field of Chicago Public Radio reports.
The fast-moving inquiry began back in September when New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer alleged in subpoenas that several funds were engaging in market timing and aftermarket trading. Neither One Group nor Bank One has been charged with any wrongdoing. One group informed its employees and investors of the likely enforcement action on its website. In a letter, President Dave Kundert says the company is cooperating with the SEC and hopes to reach a settlement with regulators in the coming months. Kundert also outlined a series of reforms to better protect the interests of investors. One group and its mutual fund advisor manage about $175 billion in assets. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field in Chicago.
A drought in Central Europe may open up grain markets for farmers in the Americas. Traders say Central European states may have to import at least 4 million tons of grain following one of the worst droughts in decades. Hungary, Poland, and Romania all report shortfalls of at least 1 million tons. They say only farmers in the Americas are capable of filling the shortfall. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney has today off. It's Here and Now. American troops in Iraq are celebrating Thanksgiving today. Turkey dinners with all the trimmings were loaded onto a truck convoy and brought into Iraq under heavy guard from Kuwait. And the heavy military guard is imperative. Today, a U.S. military convoy came under attack outside Baghdad. And on the political front, two top Iraqi clerics have criticized the coalition's fast-track plan for Iraqi elections. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Liz Palmer, reporter for CBS Television. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
First of all, tell us, where are you situated right now, and have the troops there had a Thanksgiving?
I spent the day in Ramadi with the 82nd Airborne. Ramadi's a town west of Baghdad, which has come under a lot of attack. And sure enough, as we were driving out there on that highway that leads up the Euphrates Valley out of Baghdad, we came upon a big military convoy that had come under attack, and three big transport trucks. All of them had been hit. Mm. It looked to me as if they'd been hit by rocket-propelled grenades, and they were on fire and wrecked. The military says nobody was hurt in that attack, but it does go to show that even though the Americans are saying attacks are down, they certainly are continuing, and this one was very accurate indeed. Out on the base, the 82nd Airborne were being treated to a tremendous Thanksgiving feast. They even had a paratrooper sculpted out of chocolate on the head table, and shrimps and turkey and cranberry sauce and sweet potatoes, the works.
And I would imagine that given the attacks that you saw, they're not going to be letting their guard down soon.
No. In fact, I was talking to some of the pilots of the helicopters, the Black Hawk pilots, and they say that they are a lot more tense now and much more on alert and flying in more evasive formation than they were a few weeks ago. For them, things have become more tense.
Hmm. What do you know have U.S. officials said today about the latest political setback in Iraq? This is the two Shia clerics who are demanding immediate direct elections with a role for Islam in a new Iraqi government. Now, the coalition's plan calls for the appointed Iraqi Governing Council to appoint another larger governing body to temporarily run Iraq until elections, which the coalition is calling for elections in 3 years.
It really comes down to how feasible it is to have direct elections now. The Shia clerics would like that because that would give them direct representative government and ensure that the Shia majority was represented at the national level. Mr. Bremer says he's not going to negotiate in public, but he is showing some willingness to negotiate with them to try and find a compromise. He's never negotiated in public. He knows that what this main cleric says, Ali Sistani, Ayatollah Ali Sistani says, goes. So Mr. Bremer is going to have to very carefully and very skillfully find a way to satisfy the Ayatollah's political concerns. And it appears that he's going to do it very seriously.
Mm. One last question. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld appeared to increase the total number of troops that will be left in Iraq after the troop rotations are completed by May. He's sending three additional Marine battalions, leaving 110,000 troops instead of 105,000. Now, on this Thanksgiving, I know you saw the soldiers. Are they reacting to that at all?
Well, these are the ones who will be rotated out, and so they're very much keen to get home. And I think the total number coming in is not of their concern. It seems to me that this is a very fragile period and that whatever we're hearing now is still only projections. They're certainly not fixed numbers.
Well, Liz, thank you.
Pleasure.
Liz Palmer, reporter for CBS Television, speaking to us from Iraq. Well, Americans stateside are sitting down to Thanksgiving dinners as well, secure in their homes or the homes of loved ones. But how secure are they really? How is the Department of Homeland Security doing since its inception shortly after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001? Joining us on the line is Sean Waterman, Homeland Security Editor for UPI, United Press International. And Sean, how does the U.S. measure whether it has made any progress in the war on terror? Is the Department of Homeland Security keeping count in some way?
Well, it's very difficult to measure. I mean, how do you measure it? Is it the number of screeners at checkpoints at airports? Is it the number of detainees at Guantanamo Bay? How do you we don't know that those things actually make us any safer.
The number of incidents that almost happened but didn't, which we would never find out about.
Well, they would know about that. Mm-hmm. But even then, you know, the intelligence community used a term of art called disruption. But and I reported, for example, earlier this year that they had disrupted a number of plots against U.S. troops in the Gulf in the build-up to the Iraq war. But they don't know exactly when you disrupt something, you don't know exactly what you stopped. It's not like someone snuffing out a burning fuse. It's just that something which you suspected might happen didn't. So there's no real way of measuring progress in the war on terror. And the problem with that metric, that measure, is that we don't know why that hasn't happened. Maybe they're just biding their time. Maybe there are plots in the works that we don't know about. It's really very difficult to measure our progress. And Christopher Cox, the Republican chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, actually proposed a couple of weeks ago that there ought to be a set of metrics, of measurements, so that we could somehow mark our progress towards a more secure America.
And how was that received?
Well, I mean, frankly, it was a rather vague. He didn't actually say what the metrics ought to be. He just said there ought to be some, and he wanted to start a debate and begin hearings next year, you know, that would look at how you could develop that. So, I mean, some actually suggested that that this was really, for him, a way of justifying the existence of his committee.
Well, I was going to ask you, what about Chris Cox and the rest of the committee? And the Department of Homeland Security, who is watching over them? Who is trying to take some measure of how they're doing?
Well, that is, according to officials at the department, something of a problem. There are 88 committees and subcommittees on in Congress, in the Senate and the House, that have some degree of oversight responsibility for the department, because in addition, on the House side anyway, in addition to the new committee, there are also all the existing committees. So there's this tremendous complex interlocking and overlapping web of oversight responsibility. And the result, say officials, is that they're running to testify on the Hill much more often than they should do.
Well, you have said that the DHS has more than twice the number of hearings as the Pentagon?
That's correct, even though the Pentagon's budget is something like 10 times the department's. I mean, those figures were given me by DHS officials. One thing's for certain is that the amount of work involved in preparing for all these hearings is, officials say, you know, actually damaging their ability to focus on their main mission, which is protecting the homeland.
Well, you know, we could
terrify ourselves by talking about some of the problems and vulnerabilities, and we don't want to do that. But there is one that you recently wrote about that seemed to catch your attention, but also seems to illustrate some of the problems you've been talking about, and it's the threat of agri-terror.
Yes, this alarmed me greatly. Foot and mouth disease is the most virulent disease known to mankind. It doesn't affect humans, but because of its virulence and because there isn't really a cure, the only solution, as we saw in my own country, in Britain in 2001, is mass slaughter of potentially affected animals. That's basically anything with a cloven hoof. And the Department of Defense and the Department of Agriculture have done various computer simulations about the effects of this kind of attack. And within those 5 days, an attack could have infected animals from 20 states. And by the time the outbreak was over, which would, by the way, be up to 6 months later, nearly 30 million animals would have to have been slaughtered.
You quote senators at a hearing pointing out that 80% of the beef cattle in the U.S. passed through 2% of the country's feedlots. And another senator saying that perhaps even things like state fairs should be rethought.
Yes.
And yet, you also point out that there are more than 30 federal agencies who might be involved in assessing agri-terror.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real alphabet soup of agencies involved here.
Well, on that cheery note, there is one last thing I'd like to mention
sure.
to you. There was a general warning that went out to state and local governments last week, a warning that the end of Ramadan and the beginning of Thanksgiving may perhaps lead to a target time. Your read on that warning?
Well, these warnings are issued from time to time. It's very hard to say exactly what they're based on. My own sense is that actually America has done rather well in the war on terror, certainly on the offense. And Al-Qaeda, although it still clearly has the ability to strike, as we've seen in the past few days, hasn't managed to do so in the United States. And, you know, let's hope that state of affairs continues.
That the Homeland Security works despite itself.
Almost.
Well, Sean, thank you.
My pleasure.
Sean Waterman, Homeland Security Editor for UPI, United Press International, speaking to us from New York. Thanksgiving Day 1963 was a somber affair. President John F. Kennedy had just been assassinated. Television reports were full of images of John Jr. saluting his father's funeral procession and of Jackie Kennedy lighting the eternal flame at her husband's final resting place in Arlington National Cemetery. Commentator Alice Furlow was living in New York then. She has these memories.
One comment about Mrs. Kennedy's courage in those terrible days after the assassination stands out in my memory. My husband and I were at a party in New York a few days after the funeral. Quite a few of the guests had known the president or his wife, and some of them were making rather cynical remarks about the couple's relationship. They all seemed to know that Mrs. Kennedy had taken the famous Dr. Max Jacobson cocktail of drugs, mostly speed, as I remember, to get her through the funeral. My late husband Max and I were still so moved by the long days of nonstop television, and we'd been so overcome with admiration for Jackie, watching her on television, walking behind her husband's coffin, that we were disgusted by this cold-hearted gossip. I don't remember Max saying anything that evening, although he had known Jackie well in their youth in New York and Paris, and she'd been his date at Princeton for their house party weekend, Princeton's version of a senior prom. But when one woman said, well, she didn't really love him, as a way of explaining Jackie's calm behavior, an old friend of mine, Sarah Chermayev, piped up. Most people sitting next to a man in a car when his brains are blown out would go completely to pieces, even if they didn't know him. When I got home, I wrote down that remark, and I'll always remember it, along with those television images of the Texas motorcade and the band playing Fairest Lord Jesus as the coffin was carried up the steps of the Capitol, and Mrs. Kennedy and her little daughter kneeling by the coffin. Jacqueline Kennedy will go down in history for all sorts of reasons, for bringing music and art into the White House, for helping her husband to make all of Europe love us. But I admire her most of all for her extraordinary courage and dignity in those first dark days of mourning.
Commentator Alice Furlow. And we have this news just in. President Bush is in Iraq, reportedly paying a surprise visit to troops there. We'll have more later in the program. Also later, a visit to a beloved uncle in Vermont to see the snow geese. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As the people of China surge ahead economically, one thing many Chinese can now afford is that item, second only to turkeys, that Americans do so love at Thanksgiving, the automobile. And Detroit knows it. American manufacturers are locking in deals to feed a market for cars that is growing by leaps and bounds. But the Chinese government has recently written new rules for automakers. They will only be allowed to sell cars and SUVs if they get more miles to the gallon than cars now sold in the United States. Keith Bradshaw is Hong Kong correspondent for the New York Times and formerly covered the auto industry out of Detroit. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're the perfect guy for this topic. These new rules being instituted in China, is this definite?
The Chinese have a 39-member panel of all the senior people from lots of different ministries that have anything to do with auto policy. They've all been getting together through this autumn. They've held what they say is their final meeting. They have approved the standards. Now, the standards, which are more strict than the United States standards on fuel economy, go back to all these different ministries for what is supposed to be only a legal review of the wording. And the committee is not scheduled to have any more meetings, so it's not supposed to be possible for the actual numbers, the miles per gallon they're requiring, to be changed. Now, that said, you can bet the automakers are really going to try to lobby hard for changes over the next few months. They were really caught off guard. They hadn't expected the Chinese to do this.
Mm. Well, you say they will now lobby. I just don't picture lobbying happening in China.
You can lobby in China. You just need to talk to the provincial officials, for example, who can talk to the national government for you. You can talk to different national government agencies, and I suspect we will see more lobbying in the months to come, but it will be very difficult for anybody to change these rules now because it's just not that easy to get together 39 delegates from various senior ministries in one place, and these guys are not scheduled to get together again at all.
Why are the Chinese imposing these stricter regulations in the first place?
Chinese oil consumption is going through the roof as a result of this booming economy they've got. The oil imports of China are expected to pass Japan's in the coming year to make China the world's second largest oil importer after the United States. As recently as 1993, just a decade ago, China was actually a slight exporter of oil. It had some oil fields up in northeastern China, and it was shipping oil from them to Japan. But the economy has been growing very, very fast since then, two or three times as fast as the American economy. And yet they haven't been able to increase oil output from these aging fields in northeastern China. The Chinese are getting nervous now that all of a sudden they've gone from exporting oil to importing a third of their oil. And they're trying to do something to control that reliance on Mideast oil because they're not entirely sure how much more oil they're going to be able to get from that region given some of the instability lately.
Well, these surprise and strict regulations, so they're not as much about fuel emission, you know, pollution, as they are about fuel efficiency, the economy of driving a car. How much stricter are the regulations? Can you give a comparison, let's say, with current U.S. regulations?
The Chinese standards are calculated in different ways from American standards, but just to give some examples, in the United States, small cars currently get on average around 31 miles per gallon. The Chinese will be setting a minimum of about the same for 2005 and 33.5 miles per gallon in 2008. Now, the bigger difference you're going to get is for sport utility vehicles. Now, it's important, though, to say that I'm comparing American averages to Chinese minimums. That is, in America, some of the SUVs might be, say, below 21 miles per gallon, and others are above it. The Chinese are saying, we want everything to be above 23.5 miles per gallon, for example, for a midsize sport utility vehicle. Mm-hmm. In 2005.
Well, what is this going to do to American automakers who, as you write recently, just struck a big deal to be able to export more American cars to China? Will we see a day when the Chinese government might be influencing U.S. automakers to make better, more fuel-efficient cars for American customers?
This is one more incentive for American automakers and other automakers to produce more fuel-efficient cars. But the fact is, there are lots of fuel-efficient cars already on sale in other countries, in Western Europe and in Japan. They just tend to be subcompacts. Subcompacts don't sell well in the United States. The market for the top 10 most fuel-efficient cars on the market in the United States is under 2% of the U.S. market. And as long as gas prices in the United States remain among the lowest in the world, it's likely to stay that way. Now, one interesting thing about the way the Chinese went about this is they basically followed the American model of leaving gasoline prices low. China has gasoline prices that are about the same as the United States, while telling the automakers to do more in the way of adopting the latest technologies and lighter weight materials and so forth. So it's an interesting backwards approach to trying to save oil.
Well, one last question, Keith. There in Hong Kong, you said that the motivation for the Chinese officials is for fuel efficiency so they can spend less money on oil, as opposed to thinking about, let's say, the ozone layer or global warming. But this will have an impact on Chinese pollution, and you have a real bird's-eye view of how bad that is.
Boy, do we see that these days in Hong Kong. Last week, we had a day when the visibility, even on a sunny day, got down to about 700 yards because we just had clouds of this nasty green, greenish-gray gunk in the air, and it just comes pouring over the mountains and down the Pearl River from the huge factory districts and endless traffic jams of cities like Shenzhen and Guangzhou in China.
Yeah. Keith, thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Robin.
Keith Bradshaw, correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Hong Kong. And tomorrow on Here and Now, and they're off. But will they buy? We'll take a look at retail sales on the day that marks the beginning of the holiday season. Also, a talk with Irish filmmaker Jim Sheridan on his new film, In America. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Massachusetts is now spending more money on prisons than on public higher education. Will the rest of the country follow suit? And how does this week's Islamic celebration of Eid mirror Thanksgiving?
It starts off with a kind of prayer, and then you move on to a kind of communal celebration. And one idea is that one gives thanks precisely for those things that we have been mindful of withdrawing from.
Also, listeners' favorite comfort food, and a bittersweet update on a favorite uncle, and a pilgrimage to Vermont to see the snow geese. These stories and more coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. President Bush spends Thanksgiving in Iraq, making a surprise visit to American troops in Baghdad today. It was his first trip to Iraq. The president had kept his visit a secret amid the violence in Iraq, stealing away from his ranch in Crawford, Texas. The president was to spend only 2 hours on the ground having dinner with the forces. Soldiers in Iraq have been enjoying the traditional Thanksgiving turkey and cranberry sauce. Sergeant First Class Christopher Royal with the 82nd Airborne Division out of Fayetteville, North Carolina, says his men cooked for 72 hours straight.
Right now we got over 500 pounds of turkey, 200 pounds of ham, about 5 or 6 steamship rounds cut up and one whole. We got about 200 pounds of rice for the soldiers, about 20 pans of gravy, and a lot of cranberry sauce coming.
Meanwhile, the fighting continues even on the holiday. Insurgents fired a rocket-propelled grenade at the Italian mission before dawn, causing damage but no injuries. The attack came as key Shiite Muslim leaders criticized the U.S. plan to transfer power to Iraqis, saying elections should be held sooner than planned. A U.S. military convoy was also attacked today on the main highway west of Baghdad, and an AP television news cameraman filmed two abandoned military trucks with their cabs burning as dozens of townspeople looted tires and other vehicle parts. More than 2 million spectators have turned out in New York City for this year's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Curtis Ellis has more.
I'm here at the 77th annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It's a beautiful day. 2.5 million people are lining the parade route here from Central Park down to Herald Square. Garfield the cat just went by. It's his 25th year in this parade. Retro seems to be the theme. Jake the turkey led the parade off. Same style turkey that we saw back in the 1950s. Uncle Sam is here for the first time since 1947, and the parade's wrapping up with Santa Claus, kicking off the Christmas shopping season. Curtis Ellis in New York.
That is the Associated Press's Curtis Ellis at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And on Wall Street today, the American markets are closed. They will be open for an abbreviated session tomorrow, the start of the traditional shopping season. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney has the day off. It's Here and Now. For the first time in 35 years, Massachusetts is spending more money on its criminals than its college students. $816 million is set aside for public higher education in the Bay State, while $830 million is budgeted for prisons. Are other states following the trend? Michael Widmer heads the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation, whose new report flags this dwindling education budget. Welcome, Michael.
Nice to join you, Robin.
Tell us, first of all, do we know that the decrease in school spending is because of cuts as opposed to, let's say, less students? And conversely, is the increase in prison spending because of perhaps an increase in prisoners?
Well, the cuts in aid assistance to public higher education is a direct result of the state's fiscal crisis, presumably mirrored across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Higher education often is one of the first casualties of fiscal crises. We've seen across our 29 campuses in Massachusetts cuts approaching 30% over the last three fiscal years. In contrast, the increases in prisons through the last two decades, prison expenditures have risen principally because we've added lots of prisons and lots of prisoners, and they're very expensive.
Well, let's go back to the school cuts, though. Why is that? Why are schools cut?
I think when one looks at state budgets, it's very hard to make cuts in entitlement programs that are driven by caseload, like the Medicaid program, mm-hmm. and double-digit growth in health care costs each year. So the states look where they can find easy money. And so higher education is often the scapegoat. What really happens there is that one transfers the costs to parents and students through increases in tuitions and fees.
And I guess it's easier to cut schools. You can't tell a prisoner not to come to prison, but you can tell a college applicant, sorry, you know, we've cut your major or we're just not taking a higher number.
Really, the way to control costs in prisons is to change sort of the correctional philosophy and do that over the longer term so that one doesn't have such an emphasis on maximum security and mandatory minimum sentences.
What do you mean by that, by changing the philosophy?
Well, we've had in this country over the last 20 years at least a so-called get tough on crime approach, and that has meant the heavy emphasis on mandatory minimum sentences, even for first-time nonviolent drug offenders, just drug users. That kind of approach has filled up our prisons.
And it's expensive.
It's very expensive. I mean, it's questionable correctional philosophy in terms of the revolving door that seems to be generated, but also it's very expensive, and that's bedeviled state after state.
Well, I wanted to ask you that. You say you see this happening across the country?
Absolutely. I mean, this sort of explosion of prison buildings and new prisons and sending hundreds of thousands of more people into prisons.
And cutbacks in schools.
Whether other states have quite reached the point of Massachusetts, I don't know, where prisons have passed higher education. But the reality is the trends are constant across this country, which is surging prison costs and cuts in higher education.
Well, Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Widmer, head of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation, he spoke to us from Belmont, Massachusetts. Well, today, many Muslim Americans are sitting down to their second meal of thanks this week. This year, Thanksgiving converges with the Islamic observance of Eid, the celebration following the month-long Ramadan fast. Colgate University Professor Omid Safi joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And do I also say to you, Happy Thanksgiving?
Of course you do.
Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about the comparison, but first, tell us about Eid. Exactly what is this holiday?
Well, it is a holiday to mark the end of the beautiful month of Ramadan. And whereas the month of Ramadan has been a powerful month and a beautiful month and a month of withdrawing temporarily from food and water and sexual relations and to purify one's thoughts and minds and hearts, the Eid is a chance to come back to all of those things with full vigor and to celebrate it with community, with family, and really with all of humanity at that level.
Is it a meal?
It does involve a meal, yes. The sustenance comes not just through prayer, which is a part of it, but also through the stomach.
Is it, as we read, a day of thanksgiving?
It is in a sense. I mean, it starts off with a kind of prayer, and then you move on to a kind of communal celebration. And the one idea is that one gives thanks precisely for those things that we have been mindful of withdrawing from. And this is a very important aspect of Ramadan, which continues over to Eid. debate this notion that our very sustenance, which depends on things like food and water and human relations, that these are sacred elements.
I read that the full word, and maybe I have this wrong, is Eid al-Fitr?
Eid al-Fitr, that's right.
And it literally means to break the fast.
To break the fast.
Yeah. And that it's also considered unholy to fast on this day.
On that day, there are very few days of the year in which we are told specifically not to fast, and this is one of them.
Well, Professor, I know you celebrated Eid on Tuesday and you're having Thanksgiving dinner today.
Yes.
Are they the same feelings or is there a definite separation?
You know, for me, the gratitude is the same. If there's a slight difference, it's only with which members of humanity does one celebrate. And so Tuesday was a day for us in this very small Muslim community of getting together and celebrating, as well as some of our non-Muslim friends. And today is a day of getting together with other friends as well.
I wonder if you find yourself thinking of the pilgrims, you know, you having made a pilgrimage here.
You know, we're all pilgrims.
Right.
We're all pilgrims. And into this whole world, all of us are temporary visitors, and we'll be checking out sometime soon. And into this land, we're also all pilgrims. And that idea of an encounter between people who may not have seen themselves as having much in common, but being able to share a meal and to survive together and to recognize something beautiful and holy in one another, I think that's a powerful message. And, you know, one of the lessons that a lot of us are trying to learn from is that it becomes much harder to dehumanize someone once you've shared a meal with them. And, you know, all of us are trying to somehow bring about a sense of peace and serenity into this world, but we talk about it in the abstract too often. And how beautiful would it be if we were to sit down with someone that we think of as quite distant and different from us over a meal and just see how they eat, how they, you know, take the nourishment into their body and give them a chance to also see how we do the same. And I think that that's a powerful way for us to move forward as a member of humanity.
Thank you so much.
My very great pleasure to be with you.
Colgate University Professor Omid Safi. Still to come, a reminder of just why we go over the river and through the woods so far out of our way to visit relatives on Thanksgiving. You're listening to Here and Now. Actor Harvey Fierstein started a firestorm of controversy with an op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times, announcing he would be Mrs. Claus in today's Macy's Day Parade, and speculating, what if Santa himself were gay? Would he be denied full citizenship? Well, the article was in support of the recent Massachusetts Supreme Court decision paving the way for gay marriage in this state, Massachusetts. But, hoo boy, did it get a response. Maria Hinojosa is with CNN, and her assignment today, the Macy's Day Parade, she is there in New York and joins us on the line. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Robin.
Well, there were a flurry of press releases this morning. We'll get to that. But first, everyone wants to know, what did Harvey Fierstein actually wear? He was invited to be in the parade in his character of Mrs. Turnblad from the play Hairspray. But what did he end up coming as?
Well, you know, when Harvey showed up at our live shot location, I mean, I'm only 5 feet tall. So then you have to imagine that you've got Harvey Fierstein, who's a large person as it is, and he was wearing this flowing, bright red velvet dress that just looked like nothing I've ever seen before, that you would never imagine anyone walking down the street to wear. But actually, he looked like he fit in quite well in the parade. And then he had this huge white collar and a white... Oh, I can't remember what they're called, but it's the things that are usually made out of rabbit skin and you put your hands through
them.
Oh,
a muff.
A little muff. He had a, I mean, the muff was about the size of one of my thighs, you know. So it was huge, and he just had glorious hair happening all over. I mean, he really looked impeccable and gorgeous, you know, if that's a term that you want to use. He was just...
But was he Mrs. Claus? He was Mrs. Claus then.
He was Mrs. Claus. He was absolutely wearing the outfit that he believed, as his character would believe, that Mrs. Claus would be dressing like that.
Well, in his op-ed piece yesterday, Harvey listed great Americans that he said would be denied same-sex marriage rights. They included Walt Whitman, James Baldwin, and then, as he writes, how many wedding parties have walked down the aisle to the music of Virgil Thompson, Stephen Sondheim? Yes, we get to provide the music, but we're not allowed to get married ourselves. That was the point of his op-ed. But, of course, Macy's was somewhat surprised by this because the Thanksgiving Day Parade is not a parade traditionally that has any politics in it.
No, that's right. I mean, what it's really about is a time for New Yorkers and tourists to come out and essentially have a sense of the other New York, the New York where everybody basically loves each other and is happy to see each other and makes ways for each other. It's about feeling like that you can go into a public space and feel comfortable and good and secure.
And we should point out, Macy's was quick to point out that he was not standing next to Mr. Claus.
That's right. Actually, when Mr. Claus, Santa Claus, came at the very end of the parade, as far as I could tell, he was alone with a couple of elves and the reindeer. But no, Mrs. Claus had come about, maybe 5 or 10 minutes before that. And according to Harvey Fierstein, he says that the Macy's Day Parade basically said, do what you want. CNN did not get an official response from the Macy's Day Parade on this. But again, if there was a controversy, it was not felt by the crowds. And a lot of kids apparently liked the show. I haven't seen it, but there were a lot of kids who were applauding when they saw the Hairspray characters.
I'm wondering now if we'll have a new controversy with Mr. and Mrs. Claus on two separate floats. There'll be rumors of divorce. Maria, thank you so much.
Anything can happen. You're welcome. Have a good one.
Maria Hinojosa, correspondent for CNN and host of NPR's Latino USA, speaking to us from New York. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On this Day of Thanks, a special letter segment, Your Thoughts on Comfort Food. We're joined by the person who prompted your thoughts, Here and Now Chef Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
Well, you made this casual request weeks ago, and you really struck a chord.
I think comfort food is a topic that touches many hearts and stomachs.
Yes, it does.
And the letters prove it.
That's right. Well, one of the most popular comfort foods, of course, macaroni and cheese. We had tons of letters, and everyone said it has to be just right. Now, if you'll remember, I told you that my mom used to add tuna, canned mushrooms and cheese soups, and potato chips. Well, Peter,
I remember it very well.
Right. You were appalled.
I'll never forget.
Well, Peter Van Erp of Providence, Rhode Island, and by the way, born and raised in Cleveland, was also appalled. He writes, no potato chips, a desecration if I've ever tasted one. But he goes on to say, what I really like is potatoes, boiled till they're half cooked, then fried until crisp with onions, served with my wife's meatloaf, a salad, and a beer. For dessert, finish eating the potatoes over the stove because they'll be too limp to eat tomorrow anyways.
Well, it just goes to prove that comfort food is a deeply personal issue, Robin.
Yes, it is, as we'll continue to find out. You have another letter?
Yes. Lori Hells Anderson from Horsham, Pennsylvania writes, mine is macaroni and cheese made with very sharp cheddar cheese. The cheese and noodles have to be layered with brown ground beef and the casserole topped with cornflakes.
Had you heard of that before, cornflakes?
I have heard of cornflakes on various casseroles. I mean, all these different ingredients really point to different geographics, different ethnic groups, and we don't change. It doesn't matter how old we get or how sophisticated our tastes are. We just keep loving what we loved as children.
Well, Raylan Gillis sent us her recipe, and she uses dried milk, by the way, Kathy. Hmm. She says bake it at 350 for an hour and then fight with your siblings over who gets the crusty top. But she goes on to say, this is a dish I make to bring to after funeral parties, to celebrate new moms, or to potlucks, or I'm not sure who's coming. When my grandmother passed away, there was a week-old bowl of this in her fridge. I almost ate it, knowing it would be such a comfort to have food prepared by her hands to help me grieve her death.
That's so touching, and I'm also so pleased she didn't eat it.
A week old, yeah, that's probably not that good. You've got another email there from Susan Macklin.
Yes, she's from Westford, Massachusetts. She writes, my husband, children, and myself are from South Africa. My favorite comfort food has remained unchanged for years. I make a huge pot of pasta, usually spaghetti or bow ties, and slather it in olive oil and Parmesan cheese. I always overeat, and when my husband sees the pot on the stove, he knows that I've had a crisis.
That's right. Jean Dussault of Tucson, Arizona writes, my absolute favorite, mashed potatoes and ice cream, not together. She says, my aunts made baked macaroni and cheese with potato chips, too, and I loved it. My mom did not. But they all used leftover spaghetti, never any other shaped pasta. The first time I had Kraft mac and cheese from a box was in my 20s, and my response was, yuck, this is not macaroni and cheese.
A very smart woman.
Finally, Marilyn Jackson of Charlotte, North Carolina, had an interesting suggestion, Kathy. She writes, I'm from the South, and although I love all those Southern comfort foods, my favorite comfort food, sushi, along with a can of smoked oysters and sharp cheddar cheese cut into small squares. I eat all of this with chopsticks and a bottle of wine. If that doesn't make me feel better, nothing will.
That is the ultimate proof that we are each unique beings on this earth.
It certainly is.
Sushi and smoked oysters. I think we're going to appreciate our turkey even more.
Well, and speaking of which, Kathy, tomorrow we will be having one of the greatest comfort foods of all, leftovers. So to everyone, enjoy.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, same to you, Kathy, and thanks for the inspiration.
You're so welcome, Robin.
Here now is resident chef Kathy Gunst.
Uncle Ock?
No.
Hi!
I'm often asked, how's your Uncle Locke?
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
For the past couple of years, we've played for you the Thanksgiving pilgrimage we made to visit my favorite uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin of Middlebury, Vermont. He'd always wanted to take me to see the annual migration of the pure white snow geese at nearby Dead Creek Wildlife Refuge. I'd seen the brown Canadian geese. But on this trip, we were going to see the snows.
I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe, but no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they're going to hang around.
I know.
They're going to bug off down south. Sometimes you can hear them coming, all honking away. Sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do.
There was a sense of urgency. The snow geese would soon be gone, and at 88, my Uncle Locke wasn't going to be around forever either. So, yes, we were in a race against time, but one that I didn't really tell you about.
Have you been following all the fighting in Afghanistan? And
yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting.
You see, my uncle, who cross-country skied into his 80s, was a commanding officer who fought in the Battle of the Bulge and went on to help liberate concentration camps, whose deft hands carved exquisite duck decoys and painted Christmas cards, was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. I edited much of his confusion out. I think in a way I edited Uncle Locke the way I wanted him to still be. And I rushed to tape our visit, to catch the snow geese, yes, but to capture Uncle Locke before he, too, began to slowly disappear.
I see, though. I see.
See? A lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
There they go. See them?
Yep.
Geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese!
We were just in time for the geese, and as it turns out, for Uncle Locke. His Alzheimer's has progressed pretty seriously. On a recent visit, he often forgot who we were. There's going to be no more plying him with questions about his arrowhead collection or our family history. But his eyes lit up when we asked him about the story he had told us over and over on our trip to Dead Creek, the long-ago memory of the thin white line of snow geese as far as you could see.
And tree height. As far south as you can see and far north. Just one long column of them.
I am now so thankful we had that day at Dead Creek. There were thousands of geese. They blanketed the ground like snow. When a hawk spooked them, they rose like thousands of pieces of confetti flung at the dark Vermont sky.
Oh, my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Around!
Yeah. Here they come.
That's why I look at them.
On my desk, I keep a framed copy of an essay called Lessons from Geese by someone named Milton Olson. Did you know that when they fly in a V, a flock of geese adds 71% greater flying range than if they fly alone? That they honk to encourage those up front to keep up? And that if one gets sick, wounded, or shot down, two geese drop out of formation and follow it down to protect it? My uncle's two adult children will take care of him. He'll be able to stay, at least for now, in his white clapboard house in Middlebury, Vermont. The rest of us will come by when we can and honk to encourage him. When I left after this most recent visit, I saw Uncle Locke in the rearview mirror, standing in the yard by the barn, looking upward, waiting for the geese. I drove away with my Thanksgiving memories of 2 years ago.
We're getting frozen.
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah, I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have.
It's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. Gone.
Yeah.
When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
Okay. Well, you want to get something to eat?
You want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
Our trip to Vermont was co-produced by April Peavy. To hear the original story, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. From all of us, happy Thanksgiving, and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. And they're off, but will they buy? We'll take a look at what retailers are hoping for this shopping season. Also, a talk with Irish filmmaker Jim Sheridan about his new film, In America. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.